that okay? Let's start. I spare you an introduction of myself. Actually, the story behind this talk, we're now really going to very low redshift stuff, like redshift 0.0001 or something like that. And the story why I'm giving that talk to some extent was that Pierre and I had to interrupt our stay here mid of November for the very same reason, because we had to go to a meeting in Bonn, Germany, but we are on different sides. I was on the receiving end, where he was on the giving end, meaning he was a referee of a number of proposals within the German science community, and I was one of the proposers. And so Pierre said, well, why don't you talk about that in the Tuesday seminar?
I just said I also gave my laptop.
Oh, yeah. And your green card, yeah. But that's a different story. And since we had a free slot this week, I volunteered to actually give this presentation. It's about galactic archaeology. So how we may be able to probe that interface between IGM and galaxies, in particular our very own Milky Way, with present-day data, namely just by looking at the Milky Way. So the background story is one of the very features of hierarchical galaxy formation. How do you link the mode a galaxy has been built up with the morphology of such a galaxy? And the picture which has been essentially argued over the last 30 years, starting with the work by Toomers and Toomer in the 1970s, is that essentially it kind of relates to the accretion history. When you merge stuff, you form elliptical systems. If you smoothly accrete stuff, you're forming disk galaxies. And this idea was hanging around essentially for the last 30 years, but it hasn't been till, say, the last very few years that this model actually has been shown directly by numerical simulation. We are just now at the age where we can actually check morphology in numerical simulations. And one of them I show in this little movie here, which shows the distribution of baryons. That's all what we're talking about at this conference. The distribution of baryons as a function of redshift in two projections, xy and xz. And I color encode the baryons, green being baryons in gaseous state, and blue to red being baryons in forms of stars, color encoded by their age, blue meaning stars that formed within the last 100 million years or so, red stars of ages 5 billion years or so, yellow, they're about 1 billion year old. So I just look at the movie, you see here kind of bar to guide your eye. We start, and this is all in physical view, so you start with Hubble expansion at the beginning, then see the formation of the cosmic web at the intersections where the gas cools the most efficiently. You form the very first stars, and then you see hierarchical galaxy formation at work. You form bigger objects by successively merging smaller and smaller objects. You also see here in the outskirts that stars turning old, going from young stars here to oldish stars, a 1 billion year type of old stars. And soon we will start to see the first red type of pixels out there, stars 5 billion years and older. Now by redshift 0.5 or so, also gets the impression about the morphological type of that galaxy. See a disk galaxy seen edge on and face on, this two projection, surrounded by a halo of old stars. The principle is the main features we observe for our Milky Way, a spheroidal halo, mainly out of old stars, and a disk out of a rapidly rotating disk of gas and youngish stars. Okay. However, this picture I just prescribed, and But you saw in the movie, it's quite different to what you learn if you take the average astronomy textbook and look at the chapter Milky Way. Because what they usually tell you are that the Milky Way formed in some magic event about 10 billion years ago. And there are actually good arguments for that model. Namely, argument number one, the disk of our Milky Way is thin, so it cannot have been bombarded by substantial amounts of matter. Secondly, the oldest stars we find in the solar neighborhood, actually, with this kinematics, are 10 billion years old and older. And so that's usually used as a time constraint for the age of the disk, because if you have a thin disk star already 10 billion years ago, you cannot have major accretion after 10 billion years. At least that's the current wisdom. And the disk is in strong rotational support. You have all that motion, which is kind of contradictory to that you're continuously mixed up by mergers. On the other hand side, you have seen in the movie somehow, at least in the simulation, this hierarchical structure managed to form thin disks at late epoch, something we have to look at in more detail. There are also observation constraints which actually are opposed to that picture. The first one is that most disks are not clean-cut nice disks, but they have some asymmetries. They're either warped or lopsided. And if you do statistics, you can argue that about 50%, if not more, of disk galaxies are kind of peculiar or asymmetric. And these features, if you do numerical simulation, turn out to be very short-lived. So it's very, very difficult to sustain those features for long periods of time. And a simple way out of that problem is that you just continuously excite them, for example, with accretion events. So that they are indeed short-lived, but are continuously excited. And therefore, we see it in pretty much every galaxy. So how do we go ahead from here? I showed you the result of the movie, disk-like galaxy with a fairly prominent bulge. What people usually do is just photometric decomposition in a disk of sparse system. However, I think the advantage of simulations and very soon also of new set of observation is that you actually can do much better because you have the full six-dimensional phase space distribution available of all the stars on their orbits. So you can start looking at individual stars, their orbits, and start classifying particles on different orbits. This is shown in this diagram here, in which we classify the orbits and plot the energy of the orbit versus its angular momentum. It's called Lindblad diagram, usually turned by 90 degrees. And as you know, a circular orbit is an orbit that, for a given energy, has a maximum angular momentum. This maximum angular momentum is actually this red envelope here of this distribution, which clearly shows the distribution of gas. Gas has no other choice than orbit at essentially circular velocity. The stars, some of them do the same, but you see some stars are not rotating at all. Some other stars are actually counter-rotating. So we then went ahead and decomposed and just counted how many stars are on circular orbits, on non-rotating orbits, or actually counter-rotating orbits, and came up with a diagram like this. So what I plot here on the x-axis is the angular momentum a star needs to be, or the angular momentum of a star normalized to the angular momentum it would require to be on a circular orbit. So this meaning being 1, meaning circular orbit rotating, minus 1 circular orbit counter-rotating. And on the y-axis, just the number of orbits, or stars on certain orbits. And you see this kind of feature, which you actually can understand fairly well. Suppose you have a perfectly rotating cold disk. What would be? All stars would be on circular orbits, so we just would have one spike here at 1. If you now add velocity dispersion to your stars at, say, a level of 20 kilometers per second, as observed for the Milky Way, for example, you give a finite width to that spike. Essentially, the spike you see here is a rapidly rotating kinematically cold disk. Secondly, this piece here looks like, say, half a Gaussian. So let's just mirror it, have a full Gaussian. This is essentially a spheroid that's non-rotating. and you have some residual which you actually can very well fit by another disk, but with a much higher circular velocity dispersion. And if you now start and go map particles according to their kinematics and compare it with their, say, photometrical appearance, you find that the rapidly rotating stars are actually found in a very thin type of thing. The spheroid classified stars actually look kind of spheroidally, and the residual look like something, a thick disk. So another piece of evidence, you then can ask the question, well, where do those different components come from? And a bit of skewed or strange diagram that I use here. What I plot is on the x-axis the age of each individual star in the simulation, and on the y-axis I plot the radius it has at the present day epoch minus the radius it had when it has been formed. Kind of strange quantity, but it actually shows something very nicely. Think about star formation in a disk. What would happen is a star just jumps forth and back on between both sides of the disk. So this difference will never be larger than its own 10 or 20 kiloparsec. Whereas if a star formed in some satellite, and the satellite later on has been accreted by the galaxy, this difference can be fairly large, maybe as big as the distance from the galaxy, its formation epoch, to the present-day disk galaxy. And that's what you actually see here. See, all the young stars in the model actually pretty much formed in the disk. So every star, say, younger than, say, 7 or 8 billion years, essentially formed in the disk, with differences no larger than, say, 10 or 20 kiloparsec. Whereas pretty much all the old stars have substantially larger differences, being as big as a megaparsec. So what you see here are stars that formed in other galaxies and later on have been accreted and added to the disk. So the argument I would like to make is that what you see here is essentially the thin disk, and what you see there is actually the thick disk and the spheroid. So the thick disk in this picture is not a thin disk that continuously has been heated up by encounters with other stuff. The thick disk in this picture would actually be galaxies, or would be stars that formed in other galaxies and accreted later on.
Why didn't they occupy all the distances spread over? In other words, why don't they go down to zero on that category on the right? Why weren't stars forming a long time ago, even in the location, center of this galaxy?
Well, they were. But they were not being there when they formed.
Where are they? Well,
maybe yeah.
10 and 15. They're only at large distance from the galaxy center. Why aren't they in at small distance from the galaxy center?
I think.
It's the ones on the right corner, bottom right. Yeah. Right. Why are those all zero?
Not at zero, but say, for example, centrally concentrated
If you form a galaxy from three components, they spread in space.
But they creep generally onto the potential minimum where the largest object.
Yeah, but that potential minimum still has not infinite mass, so should be at radius different from zero. Even if you have a 1 to 10 mergers, you would displace it by 10%.
Yeah. Still, I would have expected there would be an inhomogeneous patchy distribution all the way down to the center, but it would be centrally peaked.
No, it would be to the position of the most massive progenitor.
It's got a hole.
Yeah.
Where the thin disk forms.
Yeah.
For some reason, it's avoiding forming stars with a lot of arms.
If you have three globes.
Yeah.
If you have three lumps, you have zero at the center, or at the center of mass. You essentially see hierarchical galaxy formation. There's no big galaxy in place at infinite time.
So if you stick these stars over this small gap from, I think that's how we're seeing, how can you explain the inner leaf star reaction?
I come to that. Look. Okay. Okay, so the picture we get from here is that the thick disk star is not a thickened form of thin disk, but actually is of extragalactic origin. Or at least if you, say, put this view to its extreme. You certainly see that it's from some stars down here. This is illustrated in the following plot, where we actually took the morphology or the kinematic classification from the previous plot and plot the stellar age distribution, or you also can say it's star formation history, for the different components. So you see a thin disk essentially has a fairly constant star formation rate over the last 8 or so billion years, started forming somewhere here, whereas the halo, and to less extent the thick disk, essentially were dominated by early formation epochs. However, you also see some little spike of stars there. Stars that have thin disk kinematics, but are 13 billion years old, like we observe in the solar neighborhood. So stars with thin disk kinematics, which actually will predate the last major merging event, which for that galaxy was somewhere around 9 billion years ago, or redshift 1.5. So immediately ask the question, well, how did the stars in a thin disk manage to survive the last major merging event? And the answer to that question is, they did not survive it. They just have been added afterwards. So how do you add stars in a thin disk afterwards? So how do you get them from large distances to be added to the thin disk afterwards? And this is shown by the following two movies, in which I just concentrate on one satellite galaxy, this one here, and only the stars that have already been formed by redshift 1.1. And I just, again, edge on view, face on view. The disk here is just to illustrate the position of the present day disk. And we now look at that little satellite, what it is doing. It comes in on an orbit which is not perfectly, but say, tends to be co-aligned with the disk. And the result of the accretion is essentially that the stars are spread in a relatively thin type of layer, which later on get aligned with the final position of the disk by tidal forces due to the quadrupole moment of the big disk. So this satellite, so the disk assists here, the satellite is accreted and by dynamical friction pulled in into the plane of the disk. You also see there's no stars at the center, as you would expect, because just angular momentum exclusion principle. Yeah, no star coming from large distances is likely to have so low angular momentum that it can dive to the very center. On contrast, I show you a satellite in this movie which comes in on a close to polar orbit. And you see the history of the satellite is quite different to the one I showed before. It actually is spread all over the place. So that's just a picture. You should have in mind that the satellite comes in a kind of almost coplanar with the disk. It gets pulled in the disk. It comes on another extreme, on a polar orbit. It gets disrupted and added to the, say, halo reservoir of stars. Also illustrated here, just look at, say, XZ versus XY. The satellite comes in, orbital decays to the disk, and then the XZ gets actually pulled into the plane of the disk. You also see it here, say, position above the plane of the disk, oscillates a couple of times, and at the end, settles essentially within the disk plane.
So does the last major merger always end up in the thick disk, or sometimes?
Well, the last major merger can be everywhere. If it's really a major merger, it probably is added to substantially to the spheroid.
So
but if you have a spheroid,
yeah.
Yeah? And add a satellite, or with a little disk, and add a satellite on an almost coplanar orbit, it can be added to the disk at the center. Or if you add a disk to a spheroid by smooth accretion and eventually get a satellite, you can actually add it to the disk. The picture is these stars formed in the satellite and have been brought in to the thin disk of the Milky Way.
So when you have those three curves and the yellow one was the last merger, it could have gone anywhere, I guess. That last merger could have gone to any
Yeah. It probably would be, it's mostly in the actually the spheroidal reservoir of stars.
Are they eccentric?
They are not fairly eccentric. I come to that point in later. Yeah?
When James and I were looking at dynamical friction and we were finding that first of all, only the most massive gas satellites are affected in this way. That's just straightforward. The question I have for you is, and again, we found very much the same result, but the things that came in on the coplanar orbit into the disk, but those that did not.
Yeah.
The question I have for you is, did you work out the statistics, given that you've done a slew of simulations of fractions of satellites that would end up in the disk?
That's not something we want to do. Right now, we don't have the data. Right now, I essentially argue with anecdotal evidence. So, and with anecdotal evidence, say, if you now look at our very own Milky Way, do we have signs in our Milky Way that something like that happened? And the prime example, is of course, obviously, that's always mentioned, is Sagittarius Dwarf Galaxy. You have a galaxy which is tidally disrupted, surely not on a coplanar orbit, but on an almost polar orbit, coming in, and you form these streams of stars. So you actually, at least in some instances, see mass added to the Milky Way after the Milky Way formed, namely at the present day. Second example, not really a galaxy, a globular cluster, Palomar 5. Discovered by the Sloan survey, you find a satellite at distance 20 kiloparsec being tidally disrupted by the gravitational pull of the Milky Way. Actually, we can also go to other galaxies like...
What was that? Was that data?
Yeah. That's Palomar 5 data from Sloan. Next example is...
Had it been followed up to know that those stars are consistent with bonded cluster stars?
Yeah. That actually was a selection criterion to identify them. Yeah. And another one, it's Odenkirchen, Grebel, Denon and company. It's actually a quite strange globular cluster in its properties.
Mass, what is the total mass thing?
I don't know offhand. But even, say, if you go away from our galaxy, look at Andromeda, you see something similar, this little smudge down there. People put a number of HST fields down there, and this photometric identification identified something they claim is a stream of stars, in which they are actually now confined with Keck spectra, radio velocities from Keck spectra, coming in like this. And the model actually predicts that it curve like that and being in the process of tidally disrupted. So what can you do with that? You actually can do quite a number of things. For example, interesting cosmology. Just remembering when you do dark matter only simulations, pretty much every halo, dark halo, we find tends to be either strongly prolate or triaxial. Only a small number of halos actually are. Dark matter halos in simulations are actually oblate. Now, with those tidal streams, you actually can test the shape of a dark matter halo, because if you have an aspherical halo, you get precession forces, and your stream starts to precess. This actually has been used by Ibata and company to argue that Sagittarius Dwarf is an example, or is an indication that the halo of the Milky Way is almost perfectly spherical. Because if you look at the remnants of Sagittarius 12, they essentially cover a great circle. in galactic coordinates. Whereas if you would run it for a number of orbits on an even 10% flattened halo, or 70% flattened halo, this narrow feature around great circles would not survive.
What's the orbit on?
It's a circular orbit.
I mean, at that distance, what is the time period?
Oh, I don't know. It should be something like about 1 billion years. So it does say something like 10 orbits or so. It's 20 kiloparsec. So 1/10 of the very radius. Yeah. So it should be something like, yeah. So it should do something like 10 orbits over the edge of the Milky Way. Well, what's the way out of it? One way out, as proposed by Amina Helmi and collaborators, is that they actually have been stripped recently. That's not a satellite that was orbiting 10 billion years, but just some that came in. And the stars just have been stripped within the last 2 billion years. And if you do that, you actually cannot really tell whether you have a spherical halo or an oplate halo flattened by 20% or brolate halo flattened by 25%. But you actually can go one step further. If you look at stars about 4 billion years old, so say stars that may have been stripped and be around for, say, 2 or 3 orbits, then you should start seeing precession effect. And this is shown in the next diagram. So you would expect, depending on the age of the star, just some precession of your orbit. It would move to different great circles. And so they try to fit the TUMAS data from the Sagittarius dwarf and came to the conclusion that it's actually consistent only with a prolate halo. It's inconsistent with a spherical or oplate halo. It's actually the first observational evidence we have for the halo of the Milky Way not only being flattened, but also of prolate shape, as is predicted by cold dark matter theory. Well, let's go even one step further to that picture, forming stars in satellites and adding it to the thin disk. So can we find examples of that happening? And there has been an interesting paper by Amina Helmi, Julio Navarro, and Ken Freeman, who actually argue that one of the brightest stars on the night sky, namely Arcturus, has not formed in the disk of our Milky Way, but in a satellite that later on be brought in. And the argument goes back to the so-called Eigen moving groups. We look at a diagram very similar to the one I showed before. I only show here rotation velocity rather than angular momentum. So rotation velocity is a number of stars with certain velocities. You see the sun, you see something called the Hercules group, significant spike here. See another significant spike, so-called Arcturus group. And a third one I will address in a few minutes. And so these stars in those groups are less rotationally supported than the thick disk, or they are on eccentric orbit, as suggested by you earlier. And so the best way also to look at those is to check for them by metal poor stars in the solar neighborhood. Because if they form in satellites, they should be metal poor. So here's another way of looking at this Arcturus group of stars. So a group of stars that lag behind the local standard of rest by about 100 kilometers per second. And this lagging behind is usually explained by, say, interactions of, say, a disk with, say, a bar at the center. But it's actually quite difficult to get effects as strong as 100 kilometers per second. This bar scattering mechanism works at the 10, 20, 30 kilometers per second fairly well. But doing it at a level of 100 kilometers per second turns out to be quite difficult. And the other interesting part about that group of stars is that they actually follow medical pattern. So if you plot alpha, iron over hydrogen and compared with magnesium over iron, which you would expect for a small galaxy that is self-enriching over cosmic time. In this case, you expect a kind of, say, type 1 elements come in later, therefore push down this diagram at late epochs. And what you actually find is a kind of signature of such a self-enriching scheme. Well, as I mentioned, there's another example, this group down there. And this group here actually happened to have the same angular momentum, or close to the same angular momentum, as the Omega Centaurus globular cluster. So the idea we got is that actually this group of stars are, say, the tidal debris of stripped of Omega Centaurus. That actually is quite a reasonable model, because Omega Centaurus doesn't really look like a globular cluster. It has many strange properties. It looks more like a dwarf galaxy. So this is shown here again. If you plot it in this angular momentum diagram, this group gets even more visible. You see this spike here at a certain angular momentum. Again, you can use now simulation to say, guide your thinking. So we just look in a phase-based diagram. What happens to a satellite that is being tidally disrupted by the Milky Way, or this model galaxy I showed in the movie before? And you get that typical phase-based type of diagram, this circle-ish type of features in phase space, and the debris for each encounter actually assembles along a line of constant angular momentum, as shown here by the pink, blue, and green line, so for the first, second, and third orbit. So kind of identifying them, the debris tends to memorize its angular momentum. And if we actually then go to this diagram here, and you position yourself at the position of the sun, and look in radial velocity, you would kind of see a double bump feature. Overabundance of stars with a certain radial velocity, then kind of evacuating, and then overabundance with a negative. Which, if you are ideally positioned between the pericenter and the apocenter of that satellite's orbit, should be an ideal symmetric double hump structure. We show that here, comparing the distribution of the disk stars with the radial velocity distribution of the stars in that satellite as function of time, and you see this type of double hump feature. Now, can we identify that in this little spike, the group we associated with this Omega Centaurus? And the problem is really noise. We just have 13 example of 13 stars which passes cut, which pass a clean cut. This is shown here. So then this example is the example of metal poor stars compiled by Beers and Company. And here you see what happens for the stars in that spike we associate with this Omega Centaurus. So these are some indication for this double bump type of structure I argued earlier. But certainly it's no final proof of that. It certainly needs to be confirmed. Another thing, just for completeness, again, this group of stars also follows an abundance pattern very similar to a group of stars that's self-enriching. So we have at least anecdotal evidence that something like late accretion in forms of satellite happened to our Milky Way. Can you put that on a more systematic basis? And that's where the second part of my title comes in. We need better data. And we actually, what we like to have is six-dimensional coordinates, full phase-space distribution for millions of stars. Then you actually could reconstruct the Milky Way and really see where the stars in the Milky Way come from, because phase-space density is conserved. That's the ideal laboratory to look at. So what do we? So these six dimensions are, first of all, positions on the sky, distances proper motions and radial velocities, typically split in different ways how to get those data observationally, usually different campaigns for each of those items. Another big question is, what do you do? Say, suppose I give you a data set of 1 million six-dimensional positions of stars. What do you do with the data? And actually, our theoretical tools to work with data and projections of what happens, say, if I give you a million stars, positions, radial velocities, proper motions, but no distance, which is a kind of typical situation we have, or a distance with a huge error bar. What is the best way to look at this data? And I think there's quite a bit of theoretical galactic dynamics work still to be done before we actually can do that, or do it for a billion stars as we expect for the Gaia satellite. Actually, there will be a workshop next year funded by the EU and organized by James Spinney in Oxford, focusing on exactly that topic. What do we do with a billion six-dimensional phase-space coordinates should we have them by the year 2020? So what do we have? Positions of stars, we have number of million, well cataloged. Distances, we have 100,000 from Hipparchus. And I don't think that will change by a lot before Gaia actually is going to fly. For the next 15 years or so, we have to live this 100,000 precise distances. Proper motions, well, if you go to sub-milliarc second per year, just to translate that is about 5 kilometers per second at the distance of a kiloparsec. If you look at, say, the extended solar neighborhood, it would be a kind of typical kinematic velocity you would expect. We have 100,000 from Hipparchus. But what you actually now can do is, at the few milliarc second per year level, get them from catalog data. Because we now, with Sloan and Tumat, and so we get high precision data, or Quest, the project the Caltech is doing with the old Palomar Schmidt. And we have good photographic data that's 130 years old. So it's essentially a matter of image processing of photo blades and combining them with present day data. You get a 130 year baseline. You can do quite a bit with such a long baseline. Or you can even think about Sloan and extensions looking at the same patch of sky over 10 years. A 10 year baseline is something reasonable to work on in astrometry. Radial velocities, in principle, is easy, but surprisingly, we only so far have gathered in the last 130 years 40,000 radial velocities with hugely different accuracy, something from meters per second out to hundreds of kilometers per second. And you may ask the question, well, why that? And the answer for Andromeda, we have 10,000 radial velocities now with Keck. So if we're not doing anything, very soon we have more spectra for Andromeda, or better data for Andromeda than we have for our Milky Way. And the answer why we only have the view of them is that the Milky Way is too close and the stars are too bright. And so with the standard multi-object spectrographs, you expose for minutes and then have to reconfigure for tens of minutes or half an hour. So it's not an efficient way to work with. So what you need is some RAVE. So essentially, you need a project on a relatively small telescope, like a 1 meter, with a multi-object spectrograph and relatively short reconfiguration times. And the idea that crossed our mind that if you do it top-notch technology, you should be able to do 50 million stars in a 5-year campaign from the ground. It says you're getting quite a detailed inventory of our Milky Way, mostly data within the, say, 1 or 2 kiloparsec, if you're going out to, say, 50 kiloparsec, and do that as an all-sky survey. Okay. Now, to get those numbers, you'd have to do 30 minutes exposure. And if you have 2,000 fibers in your multi-object spectrograph, you would run out something like 22,000 objects per night. And if you do the math with 2 telescopes, you get 50 million over a 5-year campaign. And all these numbers seem to be entirely reasonable. And it's a nice thing, if you take spectra, you get abundances. So you do the radial velocity at the same time as you get chemical tagging of certain elements. But the problem is, the idea for doing this fast reconfiguring multi-object spectrographs is not actually having fibers that can be moved arbitrarily with the focal plate of your telescope, but like numerical simulation, put them on a grid. We have a grid of spines, the fibers connected to the spine, and then each spine you can deform by a little piezo element. It's a concept also for some of you involved in the chaos for the Gemini telescope. It's based on the same principle. So each fiber has a certain patrol area, and because of you have piezo element, you have no real robo-mechanical parts involved. You just have electromechanical parts. So you can get to those quick reconfiguration times of, say, about a minute. And with 1 minute reconfiguration time, 30 minutes exposure, you have quite a high efficiency. However, in order to do that, you need some $5 million or so, which you don't have at hand. So waiting for Gaia 2020, I don't want to wait that long. So what can you do with existing facilities? And we have one, which is the UK Schmidt telescope, 1.2 meter Schmidt telescope in Australia. It's pretty much a carbon copy of the Palomar Schmidt telescope. And it has a multi-object spectrograph, not with 2,000 fibers, just 150. And reconfiguration time is considerably longer, something like turnaround times of 40 minutes or so. But all the parts involved are also not top-notch, but less efficient, so you typically end up with exposure times of the order of an hour. So 1 hour exposure, two plates pre-configured, and then swapping. And while the other plate is observing, have the second plate being reconfigured, you get a kind of a stable mode you can run overnight. It actually is some real stress of the observer. He has to run up and down from the robot to the telescope and back. So it's really work to observe in that mode, in particular if you take something like 8 field plates a night. Anyway, we started doing that on April 11th, 2003. There's a sample of first spectra we got around the calcium triplet, as you see here, so the 18,500 spectral range. And we matched the spectra with template spectra to chi-square analysis. And for the most recent year of data, this is our error distribution. So you see, we get to an error of about 1 kilometer per second. Or you can compare it, say, with LOD spectra of standard stars, compare our Rave stars to standard stars. You actually, even in a standard star comparison, keep an accuracy of the order of 2 kilometers per second. As good as we ever could hope for, given that we have a resolution of 7,000 or so. So, current status, last week, actually, we passed the 50,000 spectra. So, we more than doubled the historical record in a bit more than a year. So far, we are fully funded until June next year. By then, we should have 70,000 spectra. We're working on the data release. We're actually planning having a data release somewhere early next spring. Do it in fully VO compatible. Put it on the VO right on the day the data become available. We have some internal working set to do some science with. And for phase two, well, we have done everything essentially we could do without lots of investment of money. So design study of the spectrograph, had some site visits for another counterpart and so on. But at the moment, we're just missing $5 million. And so what should we do? Even if you hand me the check over today, you need to build that damn thing. So at least take 2 years from next spring if you would have no data, and that's not a good situation. So one option is just to stop next summer with 70,000 spectra. But the version we actually favor right now is to continue at the mode we have right now with UK Schmidt and 6CF, but running it rather than seven nights per month at a rate of 25 nights per month, because we have the full telescope available by then. And that way, simple math, you could do something like 750,000 spectra over 5 years, and in addition have dark time available, so we can go to quite considerably higher signal to noise. Actually also investigating some mild hardware upgrades, like optimizing the spectrographs involved and so on. Something that may at least bring us to higher signal to noise, or maybe something like a million stars. And of course, continue to look for the donor to do the big thing with the 50 million stars from the ground. Essentially do all the science, the spectral science case of Gaia 10 years before Gaia actually delivers data. And well, I ran a bit late, so thanks for your attention.
Okay, just one question.
With the present survey, how do you choose your targets? This is magnitude limited for
right now, it's actually, we would love to be magnitude limited. Until now, we run whatever star we can find with sufficiently accurate position in a catalog, which is still on the southern hemisphere. And the situation will be much better with Dennis and Tumas, which we haven't used yet. But for starting 2005, we will try to have, say, an homogeneous coverage of whatever is accessible from the southern hemisphere.